Welcome to Gambling with an Edge with your hosts, Bob Dancer and Richard Munchkin. Bob Dancer is America's premier video poker writer and teacher. He's written 10 books, including Video Poker for the Intelligent Beginner and the best-selling Million Dollar Video Poker. He helped develop the computer software Video Poker for Winners, and in 2004, he was inducted into the Video Poker Hall of Fame. Richard Munchkin has been a professional Advantage player for over 30 years and is in the Blackjack Hall of Fame. His book, Gambling Wizards, Conversations with the World's Greatest Gamblers, is a testament to the many ways you can succeed at gambling. The goal of the show is that you'll be a more knowledgeable gambler tomorrow than you were yesterday. And now, here are Bob and Richard.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. I'm Bob Dancer.
And I'm Richard Munchkin.
Our guest today is Barry Meadow. Barry was a guest on our show a few years ago discussing his book, Blackjack Autumn. Today, he's discussing an earlier work about horse betting called Money Secrets at the Racetrack. We'll be talking to Barry Meadow in a few minutes. In poker, when you make a systematic mistake, it's called a leak in your game. Top poker pro Antonio Esfandieri had an unusual leak in his game recently. Richard, what was that?
Well, he apparently had some kind of side bet. I don't know exactly what the bet was.
It was lunges. He had to lunge everywhere he went. That's a kind of a squat down where you take long steps and you...
That's right. And he apparently had moved from one table to another, and it was quite some distance, and his legs were basically jello. And so he was trying not to have to do any more lunges. And I think there was $50,000 riding on this bet. And so he decided to relieve himself in a water bottle under the table.
Uh-huh.
And apparently the tournament organizers didn't think that was such a great idea.
Yeah, well, they kicked him out.
Yeah.
And he apologized. But some guys will do anything to win $50,000. Can you imagine?
Yeah, I mean, it takes me days to make $50,000.
Almost. So. Now... MGM Properties in Las Vegas, they're all going to be start charging for parking in several months. At the corner of Trop and the Strip, all the properties are owned by MGM, except for one, the Tropicana. The Trop says they're not going to be charging for parking, at least not at the outset. Personally, charging for parking has not been done in Las Vegas, and I think it feels wrong. I hope they find out it doesn't work for them. Richard, what do you think?
I hope so, too, and I have two thoughts about it. One is it seems to me that the Las Vegas Strip has sort of abandoned the idea of trying to bring in local play. They don't seem to cater to locals really much at all, and unless they're going to make some accommodation for locals you know, I think they're really just shooting themselves in the foot if they don't. The other thing is, if we look at the way they handle it downtown, you know, they all charge for parking downtown. But if you play or go to the restaurants or whatever, then you can get your parking validated.
Yes.
So, you know, if they come up with some model like that, it's a pain in the ass, but at least... You know, it's more reasonable. It's funny, though, that at downtown, these places, you know, will charge for parking and you have to go through the validation. But if you just valet, it's still free. At some of the places, I guess at the Grand, it's still pay unless you have the validation or whatever.
Well, I think valet parking is no longer going to be free at the MGM as well. That's part of this process to make us all happy.
Yeah, well, I think it will be a boon, especially for places like the Tropicana and the TI.
Well, yeah, but like if you're going to stay at the MGM and you have luggage and stuff, the Tropicana parking lot is a half mile away.
Oh, yeah, but I mean, I saw a comment. I forget who it was who basically called people freeloaders, and I wasn't sure who he was referring to. I mean, if you stay there already, they're already hitting you with a resort fee, Now, are they also going to, if they're paying for the hotel room, are they also going to charge you for parking too? To me, it just seems like a really bad way to go about it.
Well, I've been a freeloader there. When I was going to make a week or so trip out of the airport, MGM is one of the closest properties to the airport, and you park your car there and grab a cab to and from the MGM. Is a lot cheaper than parking your car at the airport.
But is that really better than parking it at, say, Walmart? Is your car safer being parked at the MGM for a week than it would be at the Walmart parking lot?
Well, it's indoors instead of outdoors, and it's easier to get a cab from MGM than it is from Walmart. I haven't seen it. I don't know where the cab line is at Walmart. All right, let's move on.
Yeah, okay.
Powerball fever infected the United States until recently. It hit last week for some $1.5 billion, shared among three winners. We received an email at gamblingwithanedge@gmail.com before the jackpot was hit, but last week's show was pre-taped, so we didn't get to it then. Probably the jackpot will get this high again, so let's talk about it now. Assume that considering everything, including taxes and the chances for duplicate winners and everything else, that Powerball jackpot was high enough to be positive EV. Now, this may be true for some players, but not for others. If you live in New York City, for example, you might have 15% tax rate that other people may not have to pay. The privileges of living in New York. But also know that in round numbers, the odds against hitting it on any one ticket are 292 million to one. The question is, does it make sense to bet a lot of money on such a long shot, even if it is positive EV? For me, the answer is no, for a variety of reasons. First, there are logistical problems with getting a lot of tickets. You can't just take $584 million in cash, I might need Richard's help to come up with that much, and say, I want one $2 ticket on every number. You have to get them one at a time. It takes an army of people, it won't work for free, who may accidentally make mistakes, miss the crucial one. Some of the lines to get these tickets are a couple hours long. Think of what would happen if one guy was at the front of the line doing 4 hours worth of buying tickets. Might be fights. Now, second, the money you spend is very real now. But it's not so real at the end. If I spent $2 million buying tickets, it would change the options in my life considerably. The money at the other end, I don't know so much. How much different would it be having $200 million and after-tax cash than $240 million? Now, to me, those numbers sound kind of the same, and yet they're $40 million different. There's a huge difference. Third, if I want all that money, the biggest change in my life, percentage-wise, would be how much money I give away to charity. Now, this makes no sense to me, to essentially throw away money to get an infinitesimal shot at winning money that isn't that valuable to me. Finally, my life works pretty good now. I'm already happy. Why would I take a very expensive path towards some indefinite happier that I don't really know what looks like? So how about you, Richard? How many Powerball tickets did you buy?
Same as you. I didn't buy any. And that's one of the things that amuses me is that people get all excited that it's $1.5 billion. But as you say, money has a utility. And if you have $100 million, $200 million, or $1 billion, are you really going to live your life any differently than – I mean, in my case, I wouldn't. You know, I wouldn't live my life differently if I had $1 billion than if I had $500 million or $200 million or $100 million. You know what I mean? So to get all excited because it's that much higher, yeah, to me just doesn't make any sense. But, you know, if I did hit $1.5 billion, I think I would order extra toppings on my pizza.
Extra toppings on your pizza.
Yeah.
Good. So we're going to introduce our guest and we're going to ask him the same question. Barry Meadow has been a handicapper and an award-winning writer for several years, also a part-time blackjack player. He was also a professional tennis player and a stand-up comedian many lifetimes ago. Barry Meadow, welcome to Gambling with an Edge.
Hi, how are you guys?
We're good. Now, the Powerball question, in a way, is right up your alley. Figuring out how much to bet in various scenarios is what your writing is all about. So, how many Powerball tickets did you buy?
I bought exactly one. I invested $2 strictly for the entertainment value. As you said, Bob, even if you've got a positive EV, if your chance of winning something is infinitesimal, it doesn't really matter. For instance, if I was playing Powerball, let's say I bought 300 tickets. I still have only about a 1 in a million chance to hit the thing. And so I'd be out $600 with virtually no chance to win, which is not a very smart use of money. People do this all the time at the races. They put in these tiny tickets on big carryover days on tickets that really have no chance to win. You might as well just mail the money in. If you have a reasonable chance to win, that's something entirely different.
Barry, are you on a speakerphone?
I am at the moment, but I could press a magic button.
I think that'd be better because you're sounding a little in a bucket.
Now I'm on a phone virtually next to you guys.
Ah, that's much better.
Uh-huh. Okay, now your book we're going to be talking about tonight is called Money Secrets at the Racetrack. That was written about 30 years ago. First, how is that book different than other how-to-win books on horse racing?
Well, Money Secrets is about money management. It's not about handicapping. The idea is you do your own handicapping. You come up with your contenders, your rank order of each horse, and then the book lets you know whether betting on a particular horse or combination makes sense. To take an obvious example, let's say you give a horse a 20% chance to win. Fair odds would then be 4-1, although, of course, we don't want to play with fair odds because of the inevitable handicapping mistakes we're going to make. I suggest you need at least 6-1 to play the horse. If he's 3-1, and you're right about how often he's going to win, you're making a long-term losing bet. So even if he wins this particular race, you keep doing this, eventually you'll be broke. And the book includes many charts to help you make the right bets. It's kind of like if you're playing roulette, you can bet number 23, and sometimes it's going to win, but if you bet number 23 your whole life, you're going to lose the house percentage.
Right. I thought, the book could very well apply to betting sports as well, where you make your line first and then compare it to what they're going to pay you, and that's what you use to determine whether you have a good bet or not.
Well, the key word in gambling is discrepancy. If you have a discrepancy between your opinion and what the line is or what the odds are, that's the time to play. If you don't have a discrepancy, in other words, you make a team a 5-point favorite and the bookmakers do the same, where's your advantage? If you have no advantage, what's the point of playing?
Amen.
When your book was written, personal computers were not available yet. Today, I'm guessing there are huge databases of various types of race information. You can run queries against it rather inexpensively. That should make handicapping easier, but you're competing against computerized teams who have access to the same or possibly even better databases, and the house still takes its 20% off the top. Overall, is the game easier or tougher than it was in 1990 for the guy who goes to the track and just uses the daily form for his information?
Well, generally speaking, the guy who simply uses a racing form is at a disadvantage to the players who watch the replays, who use the computers, who keep their own records, and that's always been the case. So I wouldn't say it's easier or tougher. It's just different. For example, if you go back 20 years, nobody was offering rebates or bonuses. Now a lot of players will qualify for them. Back 20 years ago, the only carryover available was the pick six, and now you may get carryovers in the super high five or the pick five at some tracks. And these are often positive expectation bets, or at the very least, the takeout's reduced. TVG and race replays over the Internet were not around 20 years ago, so it's much easier to follow your favorite track. You don't physically have to be at the track to bet or to follow your horses. And now there are services that you can buy that offer the statistical information you had to gather for yourself. So there are some big time savers today. For example, I used to keep my own trainer records, and when computers started doing it, I would just buy the information. It wasn't any different than what I was doing myself. It just saved me a lot of time. For a number of years, in the 2000s, there were betting exchanges, and they offered big edges for short players. It's a little bit different now. It's not as nice as it was 10 years ago. But the racing always is changing. For example, several tracks put in artificial surfaces so you had an advantage before everybody figured out how to play them. There's always something new, and if you stay on top of things, it doesn't matter that some people have what seem to be better information or real good information. If you have good enough information, you can win if you know what to do with it.
What changed 10 years ago? Are you referring to the Unlawful Internet Gaming Enforcement Act, or did something else happen?
Well, a few things happened. That was one thing. The USGEA in 2006 caused a couple of the exchanges to say, we don't want any more players in the United States. Now, there always were ways to get around it. For example, you could use a proxy server located in another country. But the exchanges, at one time, there were several exchanges. There was Betfair, there was EOSX, there was iBetX, there was TradeBetX.
I thought there was a carve-out for horse racing, though. But it was just because the exchanges did both, they didn't want to risk it?
That's right. Now, the only exchange that exists for horses is Betfair, and Betfair keeps out U.S. players. So while at one time it was great, can't do it anymore.
Uh-huh. Now, what about, because there are these very sophisticated computer teams, isn't that kind of an additional tax on the unsophisticated player? Because, I mean, the track is raking, say, 20%, but basically they're winning some amount of the money in the pool as well.
There are two points of view on that. One of them is, if a horse is 6-1, you either bet him or don't bet him at 6-1. It doesn't matter who else decides to bet on him. The other thing is, these guys are playing with less of a take, so they can play more money, and they can pound marginal numbers that you can't do. They can take 7-5 on a horse that you might need 8-5 or 9-5. So they're going to make more bets, and since they seem to know what they're doing, the fact that these rebate teams exist is difficult, makes it more difficult for the average player. But, you know, that's life. A lot of things in life are more difficult now because certain people have figured out what to do. And if that's the case, I retired in 2011, but I had three of my five biggest years in the 3 years before I retired. And that was playing right in the face of all these rebate teams.
Huh. So do you think that the general line has become closer to correct? I mean, are there less overlays that you find or did find in the last 3 years than used to be?
Absolutely. When I was doing the research for Money Secrets at the racetrack, at that time the favorites lost half the track take. That's not the case anymore. Favorites lose the full track take these days. The average price per favorite has dropped. And it's become a lot more difficult to find these allegedly underbet horses. But that means you just have to be that much sharper because the prices are coming down. I'll give you an example of how things have changed. Back in 2000, there's a researcher named Ken Massa who does a very good job with this computer program. And he had an algorithm to try to identify which horse would be on the lead at the first call, which many players have tried to do over the years. At that time, he found that if you identified that horse successfully, and this is over tens of thousands of races, you would just about break even or maybe make 1%, hitting 19% of your bets. When he did the same survey in 2010, using the same number of races and the same parameters, 18% won, which is just about the same. But instead of the return being 101 or 100, the return was only 87 cents on the dollar. And this, to me, directly reflects the fact that more people are using computer programs and they're trying to get out these things that were previously advantageous may not be that way anymore.
So am I understanding you correctly? You're saying that the favorites are very overbet and that you need to look value in the not the favorite.
Well, it's that they are they're bet correctly. They used to be way under bet. Now they're bet enough so that you can't make any money simply playing the favorites. Not that you could make money, but you could cut the takeout in half. Can't do that anymore. So the odds are getting much closer to how often these horses actually win. There's a lot less of a favorite long shot bias. There is way down at the bottom when you're talking about horses that are ninth or tenth favorites in the race. Those lose a lot more than the track takeout. But when you talk about the first, second, third, fourth choices, they're all pretty close to the same ROI, and that makes it tougher for most players.
Huh.
Let's try a hypothetical. Let's say you're at the Santa Anita Park, which some of our listeners know is about 20 miles northeast of downtown Los Angeles. You're there for the 2016 Breeders' Cup, which will be held there later this year. You bet $100 on a horse, surprisingly enough, called Bob Dancer, who amazed everybody by qualifying. Now, here in Las Vegas, I bet $100 on that same horse at the South Point Racebook. Do both of our wagers count in the same prize pool?
Well, everything you bet goes into the pari mutuel pool, unless you're playing at an offshore book that books its own bets. So whether you're getting rebates or bonuses or not, the same amount goes towards purses. Rebates and bonuses come from the betting services, not from the track. So if you bet $100 at South Point, you bet $100 by flying to Santa Anita, all that money is going to the pari mutuel pool.
But if I bet at Betfair, if assuming I found a way to do it, that would be different.
That's correct. If you were betting at the exchanges, that money is not going into the pari mutuel pool. And if you're betting an offshore race book in the Caribbean, that money is not going into the pool either. But if you're betting at a regular race book in Las Vegas, or you're betting at the track or the simulcast center, or through a rebate house, let's say like in St. Kitts, for example, that money's going to the pool.
Right. So there, Betfair, you're actually betting against other individuals. But say you had an account at Five Dimes, which is a well-known sports book, then Five Dimes just books the action themselves, and they pay you whatever the track pays, but your money isn't going into the pool.
That's right. It's just like if you bet with a neighborhood bookmaker. He's booking your action, and he's hoping you lose. At Five Dimes, they hope you lose. When you play Betfair, you're playing against other players, which is something different. And if you bet at a simulcast center or an OTB or at the track, that money's all going in the pool. So there's different ways to do it. And back when I was playing, I actually had accounts at places where the money didn't go in the pool. I had accounts at exchanges, and I had accounts at the track, because sometimes in the race, I might make different bets in different places depending on what was offered. For example, if I wanted to play the pick six, that had to go through the track. If I wanted to play a track quinella, which it's very hard to find those now, but they used to be quite popular, I could do that with a regular bookmaker. If I wanted to play against some 5-to-1 shot and I didn't care for it all, I would do that at a betting exchange, which, of course, that money wasn't going in the pool. So I had these various screens on my computer at the same time, and I would sort of pick and choose where the best opportunities were for me.
So is there some formula, let's say a horse is, 2-to-1 to win. Is there some percentage that tells you how often that horse will come in second and third and out of the money completely?
Well, there's not really a formula, but I've done the research on this. Basically, I looked at 200,000 races. And I can tell you, for example, if a horse went off with exactly 2-to-1, 2-0-0-to-1, not 220-to-1 or 240-to-1, he won 27%, finished second 20%, finished third 15%. So you just add those totals. The lower the odds, the more likely the horse is to win, the less likely he is to run third. At the higher end, the horse is more likely to run third than he is to win. If you look, for example, at horses that go off at 40-to-1, on average they win 1.5%. But they finish in the money a total of 8%. So you can see they're a lot more likely to run second or third than they are to win. So, and that goes straight down the road. If you're talking about 2-to-5 shots, they win way more than they run third. And if you're talking about 50-to-1 shots, they run third a lot more than they win.
Huh.
There's this book called The Skeptical Handicapper. It's supposed to be published later this year, written by a guy named Barry Meadow. What will that be all about?
Well, I had a column in American Turf Monthly, which is now all digital, but was a print magazine for many years. And I did a column called The Skeptical Handicapper for 11 years. And what I did normally is I would look at certain topics and I would ask questions like, is what you believe true? A lot of us believe things because we've heard it. But I like to dive deep into things and see how accurate they are. For example, what's the best way to use workouts? Do you look at how often a horse works out? Do you look at the speed? Do you look at the distance? Do you look at what trainers are doing it? How can you get an edge using workouts? What about sire ratings? Are sire ratings done in a way that is helpful to handicappers, or do they are they useless or something in between?
Wait, I'm sorry. Could you tell us what those are? What were those ratings?
It's like sire ratings or workouts, or for example, let's say you read that a sire wins 10% with his first time starters. What does that number mean? How many horses has he sired? What are the quality of the mares? Who's the trainer that the horse's progeny went to? Maybe they went to a trainer who always tries first time out. Maybe they went to a trainer that never tries first time out. So you have to look into these things a lot more tightly than you do just by looking at a statistical number in the racing form.
So that's what the new book will be about, is looking at these kinds of things.
That's right. The new book will go into a lot of, and I test a lot of stuff by computers. For example, let's say that you have a system that says, okay, I'll add the horse's win percentage plus the trainer's win percentage plus the jockey percentage, and I'll give 10 points to the one that ranks first, 5 points to the one that ranks second, 2 points to the one that ranks third. I guess I'll get a lot of winners that way, won't I? Well, checking that with thousands of races on the computer, you get 24%, and you would lose 21% because of the takeout. And almost all these little single factor things don't really work other than marginally beating the takeout or marginally not beating the takeout. The fans are very, very tough, so we can't think that the fans are a bunch of morons and we can beat them pretty easily. We have to figure out where our advantage is, and that's basically what I spent all my time doing when I was playing. What's my edge? Is the edge because I've got a carryover on a mandatory day? Is the edge because I know they're overbetting this horse because his running lines look really good, but I've seen those races, they were not very good, and I downgrade the horse. Are they not betting this jockey because he's a new jockey on the scene? They don't know how good this guy is. Are they betting a trainer because of his reputation and not the fact that, geez, he started 25 times at this meet, he's over 25? So I was looking for discrepancies, again, the key word, between what I saw and what the public might be seeing. And if I didn't find a discrepancy, I didn't play. And if I did, then I played.
What is trpublishing.com?
Well, that's my website. It includes a lot of free information and free articles on different aspects of handicapping. And you don't have to pay any money or go a password or anything. Just hit trpublishing.com. And it includes articles I've written for the Horse Players Association of North America. It includes the articles I wrote for American Turf Monthly. It includes some additional commentaries I have about racing topics. It also includes information on the books and the newsletters that I've written, because I did publish a newsletter for 7 years every month on different handicapping topics and different handicapping research.
So, Barry, a lot of blackjack, you were a blackjack player, a lot of blackjack players or other forms of AP are looking to get into other forms of gambling. You know, sometimes they try to take up poker, sometimes it's sports betting. Do you think that there are opportunities out there in horse racing? I mean, do you think that's a good option for somebody to try to dive into and make money at?
Well, you know, there are advantages in everything, and there are a lot of disadvantages in everything. If I decide I want to play poker, there's a lot I have to learn before I could become competitive. If I don't know anything about blackjack, I'm going to have to read, study, and practice to get good at that game. If I want to play basketball games, I'm going to have to learn a lot. It's not like there's free pickings just by switching from topic A to topic B. There's a certain learning curve that goes on, and how long do you want to spend with that learning curve? There are certain advantages in horse racing. There are carryovers, you can just concentrate on carryovers, which are listed every day on the Internet, and decide I only want to play those, and that's only if I can make out a ticket, which makes sense. I would say to start from scratch and just decide you want to be a professional horse player, with the sport shrinking these days, the number of tracks dropping, the number of horses racing dropping, I don't think I'd do it if I was starting out, no.
In your book, you claim the best horse players in the world played at Southern California tracks.
I don't really know that, Bob. I know that there are some good players in Southern California, but I bet there are good players everywhere. Because if that was not the case, you do research and find these tracks where favorites won, you know, 70% or favorites won 10%. And that's never the case. It always hovers around one-third. So I'm certain there are good players at every track that know the nuances of that track. However, there are certain things in Southern California that you can get. It's very difficult to get in other places. You have a lot of information source this year. You can watch every race free on the internet at calracing.com. You can get detailed reports from private clockers about the morning workouts by signing up for a couple of subscription services. It's easy to get detailed trainer and jockey stats. You can also get alternative trip notes that are not in the racing form, somebody else's opinion. There are hardly any shippers from out of state, which of course confuse things. You hardly have any, so you can get to know the local horse population. And because it's a limited number of horses, I always specialize in California racing and not on races elsewhere, because here I can really know the horses without really having to dive deep into their past performances, because I've seen them often enough, because I watched every single replay for 20 years at both Northern and Southern California. And when you do that, you get to know who these horses are. And when you get to know who these horses are, you understand what's a good situation for them and what's not, which might be they're at a certain distance, they might have had a certain amount of time off, they're against certain types of horses that favor their own running style. For example, you might have a horse that's a closer, he needs a fast pace, suddenly he draws him to a race with a bunch of front runners. You might have a horse that does not like to race on the inside, he's had two straight rail draws, and now he draws outside. So once you know these horses, that's, to me, that was always the advantage, because I knew stuff that wasn't necessarily in the form just from knowing his horses real well.
You sent us a note that said one time you won $40,000 on a pick six because you made a mistake. Did I read that note wrong?
That is correct. One time, that was the days when you got the early racing form without the actual horse numbers on them. And so I was calling in my bet to the betting service, which you could do in those days in the early 2000s. And I made up a pick six on a carryover day where I had the first five races easily. In the last race, I was 16th. There were nine horses in the race. Two of them had absolutely no chance at all. There were seven horses that were breathing. I used the six favorites. Well, as it turned out, the seventh choice won the race. So I'll make up the numbers, but I said I called the service in the last race. I wanted to use a 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and 9, but I actually called 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and 10. And wouldn't you know, number 10 was the winner. And so I lucked into an extra $40,000, and I called my betting service that night, checked what was in my account. And I said, that was a very happy mistake.
Yeah, I love it when that happens.
Of course, I'm sure the opposite must have happened as well. But right, I mean,
well, everybody at the track, just like everybody at the poker table, has bad beat stories. The time they were shut out on what would have been a big pick six, or the time one time I got into a minor auto accident at a time when you had to be at the track to put the bets in. By the time I got to the track, the pick six had started, and I would have won that. That only cost me $9,000. So I guess overall, I've had good lifetime luck.
So you're still 31,000 ahead.
You know, the phone line, you got a busy signal when you were trying to call on the phone, or your internet went down at the very moment you were about to hit the send button, or you called the wrong number, or the line was long, or whatever it is. We have to get through that as players and not dwell on unfortunate incidents and just move on to the next race, which some people are very good at, some people are not so good at.
So what's more important, the handicapping or the betting?
Well, I think the most important, because if you can't handicap, you have no way of determining whether you're getting value on a bet. You have to be able to assess the horses and come up with some kind of order of who you like best, who you like next best, how close your top two choices are. So you have to be able to handicap, but you also have to be able to bet. Let me give you a ridiculous example. Let's say that I'm the finest handicapper in the world, but I bet 100% of my bankroll every single bet. Well, even if I have 30 winners in a row, the next time I bet and I lose, I've lost all my money. So there's a mix of having a handicap properly to be able to figure out what to play, and then sizing your bets properly so you don't overbet or you don't kill your own number in the pool, or you don't wind up running out of money before the seventh race and things like that. So they're both important, and I wouldn't downgrade either one.
The book we were talking about today, is about the betting. If somebody wanted to learn to handicap and wanted to find books that'll teach him how to do that, now I assume the skeptical, your skeptical handicapper was a good place to start. But are there other good books on?
Absolutely. There's a lot of places. Now, let me tell you how I started learning handicapping, because I used to play the harness races full time. I did that for 5 years. And I said, well, I bet I could make more money in the thoroughbreds because they had pick six was a new thing, and there's a lot more money in the pool. So I was betting pretty high. I was starting to affect my own numbers at the harness races. So I decided to learn thoroughbred handicapping, which, of course, being an egomaniac, I thought I could pick that up real easily. It wasn't that easy. But one thing I did when I started, I would listen to the free replays that were on the National Turf Service, where they not only pick the horses, but they explain why they picked horse A and horse B. And the reason to do that is that race is fresh in your mind. And you say, gee, I like number three. I like number four. Why do you like number four? What did they see that I didn't see? They still offer that service, by the way, and they're still in business after all these years. So I did that every day for 6 months. There are also a lot of good general handicapping books that have been around for years. The Complete Handicapper by James Quinn. There's Buy Your Own Speed by Andy Byron. There's Betting Thoroughbreds by Steve Davidowitz, who writes for Gaming Today. There's Handicapping 101 by Brad Free, who does selections for the Racing Form. So, and then, of course, they're all available at Gambler's Book Club. So there's plenty you can read, and then you can study. You can watch TVG and listen to the selections, why they like a certain horse or why they don't. Not that the people on TVG are professional gamblers, far from it, but at least you're getting another opinion on why they like a certain horse, and maybe that's going to help steer you either on or away from certain horses. Although, once you're doing this full-time, you don't care what anybody else thinks. If 10 people say you're an idiot for betting the three, you still bet the three.
You had something in there that I found interesting, and that was where you can compare the prices, and rather than betting a quinella, you bet it as a parlay or something, or vice versa. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Well, there was a time when you had quinellas were popular at tracks, and you could simply compare the exacta prices with the quinella prices and see if there was a discrepancy. But eventually, the quinella pools became so small that almost all the tracks dropped the quinella. You can compare daily doubles to parlays, but a parlay, I mean, I don't really care about parlays. It's a ridiculous bet because it doesn't take into account how much you like the second horse in the parlay. It just simply says, well, I got X number of dollars now, I'll throw it all on the second horse. So parlay, it doesn't mean the double is better, but of course the double, the takeout is only taken out once, whereas the parlay is taken out twice. But that doesn't mean the daily double is a particularly great bet. It's kind of like if you see the two ugly girls and one girl is uglier than the other one. It doesn't make the one that's less ugly pretty. So you have to always compare what the odds are, whether it's worth making that bet or not, and every bet is individual. Some races, the trifecta is a good play for different reasons. Sometimes you have a super high five carrier, or sometimes you should be playing the daily double. Sometimes you make a place bet. So, and that's all explained in the book. I use a lot of different charts to show, hey, well, this particular situation is an overlay, this other situation is an underlay. And I always use that chart right up until the time that I stopped playing because I said, you know what, I'm going to rest now. And that's what I've done.
All right, we're talking to Barry Meadow. We're going to take a brief break. And when we come back, we are going to be asking Barry about an award-winning article that he wrote called Statistics and Garbage, which sounds like a pretty interesting story. The South Point has more than 10,000 games, returning more than 99%. This is more than anybody else has. Every Sunday through Wednesday in January, total of 17 dates, although more than half are gone, you earn a free spin for every $2,000 coin in video poker or $500 coin in on slots. Limit of 4 spins a day, lowest prize $7.50 in points, which makes it a .375 promotion. I've averaged about .6 on my spins so far. The new semester in free video poker classes will begin Wednesday, January 27th at noon in the Grandview Lounge. The first class will be Jacks Are Better. In about a month and a half, I'll be teaching an advanced class on 8-5 bonus poker for the first time. To have a shot at getting benefit from that class, you need to know Jacks Are Better at the intermediate level, at least. At the Palms, you may earn tickets for Friday and Saturday night drawings at 7:15 p.m. These pay out $6,250 a night, and you must be present to win. This is a change from the Palms pattern for the last 6 months or so. It, you did not have to be present. You could just pick it up before midnight. Now you must be there, and it's on two nights a week, not one. PFP, Play for Prizes, Monday through Friday. Until January 29th, you can earn Costco gift cards. Cards are redeemed at 0.2%, up to $190 a day. You keep the points. If you're listening live, tomorrow, Wednesday, January 20th, you'll be able to swipe and get a random multiplier. There's a limit of 40,000 bonus points for the day for video poker and no limit on slots. At videopoker.com, it's the best place to play a lot of games. If you sign up for the Gold membership, $8.95 a month or $79.95 a year, this allows you to get corrections on most of the game. It's a good place to practice quick quads. I'm quick quadded out at the moment. I played 18 hours yesterday. It was double point days at the at South Point. I did well, but those long days are harder than it used to be. The game of the week on videopoker.com is 10 play Super Draw 6. This is a 10 coin per game line. It plays like normal 10 play, except that each hand receives an extra card on the draw and becomes a 6-card hand. There are some payouts that are only possible when you get 6 cards. In double-double bonus, for example, in addition to the normal payouts, you receive 45 coins if you get 3 pair, 60 coins for a 6-card straight, 125 for a 6-card flush, 200 for 2 separate 3-of-a-kinds, 2,000 for 4-of-a-kind plus a pair, 4,000 for a 6-card straight flush, and 8,000 for a 6-card royal flush from the ace through the 9. With the extra card and all those additional pay schedule categories, some of the plays must be different than in regular video poker. So far, I know of no commercially available software that will provide correction to help you figure out the strategy. So if you can create such software for yourself, that'll give you the edge. For the rest of us, we'll have to wait until the strategy appears. All right, we're talking to Barry Meadow. And not so long ago, he wrote an article called Statistics and Garbage and won an award for it. So first tell us about the award, and then tell us what the article was about.
Well, the award was the Ron Rippey Award, which is the first time that award was given, and it was for the best article about handicapping that was published in the media. So I was fortunate enough to be selected for that, and the article was Statistics and Garbage, and the reason I wrote the article was that, as you said earlier in this program, you can do these queries and get all kinds of information from computers, which you couldn't do in the old days. But accumulating the data is one thing. Interpreting correctly is something else altogether. And the problem, there are a lot of data miners out there that start looking for things, and they believe they found something, and then once they start playing it, they find, whoops, what I think I found, I didn't really find. So the article is a way of seeing how you should do this and what are the traps when you're looking through statistics.
If you go to the track, there's all kinds of people selling you systems. Have you found any systems that were long-term profitable?
Well, when I did Meadows Racing Monthly, we tested 31 commercial systems on large databases where there were sometimes 10,000 plays, 20,000 plays, 50,000 plays. And out of those 31 systems, a lot of them were hyped and they were sold all over the country. Out of those 31 systems, the number of profitable ones after those tens of thousands of races was zero. And there are reasons for that. One reason is that the people selling the systems just lie. They just make stuff up. They say, yeah, we had 30% winners, an average payoff of $12. Oh, no, they didn't. They just made that up, much as if I say there's a unicorn outside my office right now. But some people sincerely do research, and they go, yeah, I think I got something. But then when they test it forward, it doesn't work. Just to give you kind of an obvious example, let's say that you're playing at your local track, and you notice, gee, a lot of class droppers seem to have been winning lately. So I think I'll run a query on class dropping winners the last 3 months at the track. Well, you already know a lot of class droppers have just won, so doesn't that sort of bias your sample? The trick is to test things in large numbers and on databases that were not the database that you came up with the original idea. You have to test it on a completely different set of races. And if you test it on 20 races, that doesn't help. You need to test it on many, many races. The higher the number, the better, especially when you're dealing with long shot systems. When you're dealing with favorites that pay $220 to show, you don't need to test the 8,000 races. But if you're talking about some system that the average payoff is $30, those horses don't win very often, so the standard deviation is very, very high. You've got to have a very large number of races to test. So gathering of this horsey data is not much of a problem because computers can help you. But starting with these already known results and looking for patterns that might have contributed to the results is not the way to do this. You have to test it on a totally different set of races. And there are a lot of statistical errors that people make when they're trying to do this. And if you don't understand how to do this, your results are not going to be what you want.
Touts are all over the place. Now, you said that you had, you know, this phone tout, a guy in his 80s, and he was a phone tout.
Oh, yeah, this happened a number of years ago. I was privileged, you might use the word loosely, to watch a fellow named George from England who would call up the people on the sucker list and say, I got a hot one running today. All you got to do is bet, you bet $200 for me, and I'll give you this. Now, remember, I don't win unless you win, so I really want you to win.
I'll bet.
So I'm giving you my best horse. Well, if the horse happened to win, George would wait weeks before he called the guy back, and he'd say, boy, I have another one for you. You know how much on the hook that player is at that point? And if the horse lost, well, maybe the horse had a bad trip or the horse was in a pace duel, whatever that thing was. George could make an excuse, but that one lost, but we got an even better one going tomorrow. And he existed for years on the gift of gab, and that's what touts do. They have a story. They have the secrets of the backstretch they're going to let you have for a very small amount of money. But let's face it, if people really knew secrets on the backstretch, would they be up at 5 o'clock in the morning to walk through manure to get to their job? Probably not.
Damon Runyon had a famous story called, I think it was called, But a Story Goes With It, about a guy who, it seemed like, you know, everybody has a horse that they think you should bet, but if there's a good story that goes with it, that makes all the difference, you know.
Well, it's all part of the sales. If I say I want to sell you a carpet, you may not care, but if I say that carpet was handmade, it's silk, it's from the smallest village in Turkey where they have the finest carpets in the world, and I was just lucky enough to get this particular one, and I only have one of it, and if you don't buy it today, who knows if it'll be here tomorrow. You're more likely to buy it, aren't you? People just love stories, and as a result, they can be suckered by stories.
We were talking earlier about using the computer. Are there any phone apps that are out there that are useful in handicapping?
Well, there's a lot of websites and information sources, but whatever you can get on your computer, you can also get on the phone. Used to be in the old days, if you wanted to make a phone call from the track, you had to go to the security office and somebody was watching you make a call. Later, the track offered pay phones. These days, nobody cares if you bring a phone or a computer to the track. Plenty of places offer Wi-Fi. So you can use anything that you use at home. But is there some secret thing that only three people in the world know? Not really. It all comes down to the same thing. You have to know the horses. You have to be able to figure out who's offering value. And then you have to be able to bet when you have the opportunity to bet. And that has probably never changed since the days of Pittsburgh Phil, which was 100 years ago, and I recently reread his, you know, the Racing Maxims of Pittsburgh Phil, and virtually all of them, it could have been written yesterday. So the stuff doesn't really change, all the technology might change.
Thank you, Barry. We've been talking to Barry Meadow. We welcome your questions here at Gambling with an Edge. Send them to us at gamblingwithanedge@gmail.com or at facebook.com/gamblingwithanedge. Or you can tweet them at me at RWM21. You can get the show delivered to you automatically every week. You can sign up to do that at iTunes, Stitcher, YouTube, or at my site, richardmunchkin.com. To find an archive of every episode ever done, you can find that at bobdancer.com.
Very good. So we thank Barry Meadow. Thank you, Richard. Go out and hit lots of royals, everybody. Good day.
You've been listening to Gambling with an Edge with your hosts, Bob Dancer and Richard Munchkin. Subscribe to the show in iTunes, and episodes will be delivered to you automatically every week. Archived versions of past shows may be found at bobdancer.com and richardmunchkin.com. We welcome emails at gamblingwithanedge@gmail.com. Bob Dancer and Richard Munchkin are both available on Facebook and welcome your questions. The sponsors for the show are the South Point Hotel, Casino, and Spa, the M Resort, the Palms Casino Resort, and the website videopoker.com. Join us again next week for another Gambling with an Edge.
Views and opinions expressed on this program were those of the hosts and guests and did not necessarily reflect those of Vegas All Net Radio, its affiliates, or its parent company.